Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Things I Forgot Were Good For Me. This week we're going to be talking about spreading kindness and how it can make the world a more accepting place with our guest, Houston Kraft.
And he is a speaker, author and kindness advocate who has spoken at over 600 schools or events internationally. In 2016 he co-founded Character Strong that helps teach social and emotional skills. And to date, they've worked with over 5,000 schools globally, serving over 2.5 million students. In 2020, his first book, Deep Kindness, was released. His mum is his hero, and her best life lesson is to hug like you mean it.
Firstly, Houston, it's a real pleasure to have you on here. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and giving us your time this morning. Because it's morning where you are. We're obviously in the afternoon here. The first thing I wanted to ask you was, what does kindness mean to you?
It's a great question. I've been thinking about it for a while. And to me, I mean, to your point, I'm here early in the morning. And I would say kindness is harder in the morning for some people, you know? Mm. And kindness is harder in different places for some people. For example, I think I wrote a book about kindness, but like when I'm in the car, kindness is way harder. I forget all about kindness in the car. I think it's one of the interesting challenges of the world. I really deeply believe that kindness is a key ingredient to a better, more compassionate, more just world. It is the baseline. Our ability to practice kindness towards others and our ability to practice kindness towards ourselves is essential to the kind of world that I think we all want to live in. But one of the challenges is the word itself, and words can be clumsy things, and words are like brands. You know, there's marketing campaigns around words, and I don't think whoever's in charge of kindness has not done a super effective job.
Oh, I agree.
In my opinion. And the hard part is when it's well-intentioned. I think we collectively talk about kindness, I believe, in a well-intentioned way. And by way of background, my work for about a decade was speaking in high schools and middle schools. So now I run a curriculum company that helps teach things in schools. But for a long time, I was like in gymnasiums talking to a room full of like 700 middle schoolers about kindness. And as I would go from school to school, I would see a lot of posters talking about kindness. And the one that I saw probably most commonly, and I still see it online and posts, and it's throw kindness around like confetti. Mm-hmm. And one day I was sitting outside and I was like, that's the book I want to write. I want to call it Confetti. And I want to talk about how unintentionally we've made this really beautiful, challenging thing fluffy. We've reduced it. Unintentionally, you know, you think about kids in schools looking at that poster, throw kindness around like confetti. The unintentional consequence is believing that kindness is as simple or as easy as free as throwing confetti around. And my simple argument is, if it were that easy, the world would be a much more kind place. But unintentionally, what we start to believe is that kindness is this free thing. And I think one of the most damaging narratives we could offer, not just young people, but all of us, is the idea that kindness is free. So part of my definition of kindness is that it requires something of us. Almost always, there is a cost, even if it's simply time, which you and I, all of us know, time is a limited resource. We have to be on 17 Zoom meetings a day. We don't always have time for kindness. At the very least, I think it costs us time, but probably usually a little bit of effort. And in a time where I think a lot of people are exhausted regularly, we're tired, we're overwhelmed by the inundation of the things that we have to do, by feeling overworked, by the daily news that we have to ingest and the way that it changes the way we think about the world around us, like we are tired. And so the idea of giving of our energy is its own sacrifice. And then the argument I would make is on the higher levels, the kind of kindness the world needs requires a lot more. It requires a sacrifice of pride, of ego. Mm-hmm. Requires humility and vulnerability to listen to people who are really different than us, to consider perspectives that are wildly different than our own, to really pay attention to someone whose lived experience is so far away from ours that it feels foreign, that we have to exercise imagination to extend ourselves into their lives, to humble our own opinion or strong feelings in a situation, to consider someone else's, or to really give a lot of ourselves to serve someone's needs who maybe need something way bigger than we do or that we could even understand. And so I wanted to call the book originally Confetti, but the publisher was like, don't call it the thing that you don't want people to do. Yeah. I was like, all right, good call. And so in the book, I refer to this kind of kindness as deep kindness. It's like this practice that requires a sacrifice of time, requires us to extend empathy, and it requires action. So that's a long definition to a short answer, but I wrote a whole book about it, so I can't answer it in one line for you.
Well, it's a very complex subject. I was thinking, as you were talking as well, we were talking about energy and using energy, and I guess if to focus it maybe to an online world, it seems that obviously we see a lot of negativity and noise and anger, and it feels to me, as a personally, I find... I try and advocate and promote kindness and positivity as much as possible. And there is and like you say, you have to devote a lot of energy to that. But it feels to me also that you need to devote a lot of energy to being negative and noisy and angry. But it does feel like that is a go-to emotion. Why do you think people find and this is just my perception, easier to be negative and unkind than it is to be kind?
So many things. One of my favorite premises from a guy named Dr. Ross Green, he's a child psychologist. He says, kids do well when they can. Not kids do well when they want to. Kids do well when they can. And my simple edit to Dr. Green's statement is, I think people do well when they can. Mm-hmm. And his argument, the only reason why someone wouldn't behave in a way that... maybe let's use kindness as an example. People wouldn't behave with kindness towards themselves or others. He says there's two big categorical reasons. The first one is unsolved problems. And the second one is lagging skills. So the first one, unsolved problems, the simple description in my brain is like, there are things that are happening in the background that affect the foreground. There are things that are challenges in my life, traumas in my life, things that I haven't been given the time or the tools or the attention or the care to solve. And so I have these things that are painful, these traumas that are these adverse childhood experiences, whatever way you want to think about it, that when they are not solved, I operate from a place of scarcity, or fear, or anger, or bitterness, or resentment. These things that maybe we're not even conscious of all the time, but that impact the way we show up in the world. So until some of those problems are solved or at least addressed or acknowledged, those things can rule a huge portion of our life. The other one's lagging skills, which is where I feel most passionate in my work, is I'm a believer that kindness is an action. Mm-hmm. It's a behavior, and behaviors are external things that are informed by a whole lot of internal stuff. So if I haven't been taught how to regulate my emotions, then kindness gets really hard when I'm feeling anxious or overwhelmed. If I haven't been taught how to take on other people's perspectives, then kindness gets really hard when I'm trying to be kind to people who are different than me, right? If I haven't been taught communication skills or vulnerability, then kindness gets hard when I have something to say, but it's really like scary to say it to someone. So I think a big reason why most people don't do this thing that we think is simple is because it's actually really quite complicated. Kindness requires a whole set of skills in order to do this outward behavior. It requires vulnerability, empathy, humility, emotional regulation, all of these things operating all at once in order to give even something as simple as a compliment, let alone something as complicated as like showing myself compassion when I feel damaged or hurt. And then the unsolved problems piece is like, we know we're just recently in the era of therapy or things like it being normalized. So we have generations of people who have unsolved problems that were never even given the opportunity to navigate them. So I think on like the macro level, I think those are the big buckets that I would argue make kindness hard for most people. The second one is, I think it's the whole like people crave Advil more than they do vitamins. People more readily take Advil than do vitamins. Yeah. I would argue that kindness is a path of more resistance, that the passive experience is to be angry. You know, working with high school students, one of the things that you see often is kids have this like narrative that it's cool not to care. And my argument is actually, it's not that it's cool, it's just easier. It's easier not to care, because when you care, caring is a vulnerable action. You're extending yourself out there. When you care deeply about something, the more you care, the more you risk the pain of rejection, the more you risk the pain of failing at this thing, the more you risk people laughing at you for the thing. And so it's easier to play small, and kindness is almost always an act of vulnerability, of courage, of bravery. And so I think that kindness is the path of more resistance. And, you know, in a world where we have lots of other things to worry about, it's easier just to be angry. It's easier to be apathetic.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's such a powerful answer. And I think that's how kind of we connected as well, because I get really cross about the way that kindness is kind of framed and couched as sort of something for primary school children. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, kindness is something we talk about for 5-year-olds. You know, we need to tell 5-year-olds to be kind. And it's like, actually, it's like you said, one of the most complex skills, one of the most difficult habits, one of the most courageous things that, you know, all of us can do every single day of our lives, particularly when you say, you know, we're faced with challenge. I mean, it's easier to be kind when everything's going your way and when you feel safe and secure and you feel like you're being validated and you've got all your needs met. But, you know, take some of those things away, and it takes even more energy and more kind of resolve to actually be kind. And just listening to what you said there, I think the one thing, that the kind of umbrella term that for me anyway, that sums all of that up, is that kindness takes courage. Like when you were describing all the things that you need to do to be kind, I was thinking, God, that's like the most amazing Marvel superhero or kind of character you could ever imagine. And yet we treat kindness like it's something which is innate. And I think it probably is innate, in that we want to connect to other people, and kindness is a way to connect to others. But actually, just because it's innate, it doesn't mean that we can actually practice it easily or regularly or make it actually something which can have an impact on other people.
Absolutely.
I mean, do you think that kindness is innate? Do you think that we're born with a sense of kindness and a desire to be kind and to help other people and help ourselves?
Definitely. One of my, I love words generally. And one of the things I learned a few years ago that stuck with me was the idea that the word human in Arabic translates roughly to forget. So the idea that just being human is a process of forgetting. that I think we're actually born with most of the things that we need.
This is why we got you on the podcast, because this podcast is Things I Forgot Were Good For Me. So you just totally illustrated exactly why this podcast exists.
Yeah, you could call this podcast human and it means the same thing, right? It is that we're always in the process of forgetting. And I think it's partially because culture has a knack at helping us forget. Culture pushes a whole lot of lies into our world. And it's, I think the process of remembering is an active one. So I would argue that kindness isn't something you necessarily, I mean, kindness is something you can teach, absolutely, but it's also something you remember, right? You can remember the playfulness, the connectedness, the total lack of differentiation as a kid that you have, that you learn so many of the categorizations that exist in the world, that when we categorize things in a lot of different ways, our brain so naturally craves understanding. It wants to know, what is this versus this versus this? It's a human thing. I listened to a podcast a few years ago. It's a great one. You've probably listened to it before. It's Invisibilia by NPR. It's the invisible things that control our lives. And it said our brains need categories, because otherwise you're like, is this a chair or is this a bomb? Like, we need to know the difference between the two.
That's an important one to know.
That one's huge. But our brain does it.
Don't sit on that.
In dangerous ways too, which is, oh, this person is from this place, or this person grew up like this, or this person's sexual preference is this, or this person's color of the skin is this. And our brains, they're not a nuanced categories unless you spend a lot of time listening, asking questions, reading, humbling yourself, learning, paying attention. Then those categories become broad sweeping holders of ideas that it's really easy to then associate all blank do blank. All things that look like a chair are things that I can sit on. But then there's the whole negative side of that, which is all people who look like this are blank, blank, or blank. And so I think that that's the thing that we have to, in many ways, unlearn or remember, is the perspective that was sort of like moved out of us over time by culture telling us. There's so many inputs that tell us these narratives that we have to pay really close attention to if we want to rebuild them, if we want to remember the things that are more fundamentally true, which is that everyone is deserving of belonging and love.
Wow. And obviously you're in the US. Have you noticed kind of in your work, in your writing, in all the different projects that you do, have you noticed any differences across different countries or cultures in terms of how they view kindness, like the priority that they give kindness, or how kindness is shown in terms of action and the general attitude to that?
Yeah, it's I'll never forget speaking at a high school in Texas. And after the presentation was over, some kids came down, and there's this one kid in particular who was a senior boy, 12th grade. And he walked up to me and he goes, "Hey man, I just want to let you know that after listening to your talk today, I realized I'm a really nice person." And I'm like, okay, good. I assume that's kind of the point, I guess. And I thought he was mocking me, right? Like, it's the tone, the compliment was so bizarre. I was like, cool, man, thanks, see you later. And he goes, "No, you don't understand. I realize that I'm nice, but I don't think I'm kind." I'm like, okay, well, what's the difference to you? He goes, "I don't know. The way you talked about it today, it made me realize that I think most people in my school are actually nice. Even though they would say that they're kind, they're just nice." He goes, "I think nice is reactive. I'll be nice to you if you're nice to me. I'll be nice to you if I agree with you, if I play on the same team as you, if I look like you, if I like you. I'll be nice to you if maybe if you like drop something, I'll go and pick it up." He goes, "But the way you talked about kindness today made me realize that if nice is reactive, kindness, I think, is a proactive thing. That I shouldn't have to wait for someone to be nice to me before I can practice kindness towards them. That I don't have to agree with you in order to be kind towards you. That you shouldn't have to drop your things before I think about helping you or paying attention to you." And this like senior boy, he was overcome by emotion, kind of suddenly. He like stumbled upon this truth. He goes, "Why do we always wait for bad things to happen until we practice making people feel good?" I was like, well said. He goes, "The way you talked about kindness today, I realized that it requires a lot of work. And I think I have a lot of work to do. I was like, yeah, man, me too. Wow. Well said. And I tell that story because I think that's, at least in the US, I find that a lot of people who would say they believe in kindness practice niceness, which is they practice it when they feel like it. They practice it when it's convenient to them. They practice it with people who look like them or think like them. But as soon as it's more challenging, as soon as it gets uncomfortable or requires us to be proactive, it's a different story for a lot of people in the US. And it's one of those unintentional narratives, but nonetheless true, that most people here are more nice than they are kind. And I don't think that's true everywhere. I think some cultures, at least in my experience, have a deeper sense of obligation, a sense of responsibility communally, places that value interdependence more than they do independence, I think have a more natural sense of compassion and obligation towards more than just self. You know, that's what culture does, though, is a culture in the US that promotes independence at all costs, that promotes individuality over community. You're going to find that it's at times an every person for themselves narrative, because that's what we've created. That's what we've offered here as most important.
Wow. And what about, so we've spoken about kindness towards other people, which is obviously very important, even more important, I think, in the times we're living in right now, and something which the pandemic, I think, has brought back into focus. But what about kindness to ourselves? Because I think this is one of the things that probably universally every human struggle, well, maybe not every, but most humans struggle with actually being kind to themselves, myself included. How can we be kind to ourselves, and what does that look like, and what does that mean? Because I think for me, it's much easier for me to be kind to someone else than it is for me to be kind to myself frequently.
Well, I was going to say, I was going to add to that, because some people do sort of say you can't be kind to other people unless you're kind to yourself. There's a flip side to that. So again, I'd like to explore that as well.
Yeah. I think of a few things. One of them is my favorite author and speaker, Dr. Brené Brown. You know, she's a ton of research on vulnerability and empathy, and she's interviewed and sat with thousands of people having conversations around things like this. And one of the things that she shared when I heard her speak a few years ago that I thought was really profound was that in her research, she discovered that the most compassionate people were also the most boundaried people. Meaning the people that said no to lots of things were also the ones who are most objectively, from their behaviors, outwardly kind. Like, that feels paradoxical, right? That feels like a little bit backwards. And she gave a great example of, you know, for her, it was like being a part of the Parent Teacher Association. Someone asks her to like make brownies, and she actually doesn't have time, but she signs up out of a sense of obligation. And then at midnight, after she's done a billion other things around the house, she's making brownies and she's exhausted, and she's making the brownies with like hate and resentment.
There's hate in each of those brownies. Yes. Being baked in slowly.
Exactly. And that was her point. She's like, and you can taste when brownies have hate in them.
Yeah. I believe that.
So doing things out of obligation or out of resentment, the question there would be like, maybe to an outside observer, that action is kind. But is it actually kind? Is it being done out of a sense of generosity and love, or is it like a sense of obligation and resentment? And she tells the story of going on Oprah for the first time, huge opportunity in her career. And Oprah loved what she had to say so much that she said, we want you to come back on the show again tomorrow. And she goes, that's a Tuesday. That's when I take my girls to school. And the whole Oprah team was like, yeah, but this is Oprah. And she's like, no, that's the day I take my girls to school. I can't sacrifice that. And Oprah apparently calls her Boundary Brené. And they wanted her back more because of it, because she had such clarity on what was okay or not okay in her life. And I remember sitting in the audience being like, oh boy, I struggle with that. and I do oftentimes will do things that I think are people would consider kind, but I'm not doing it from kindness. I'm not doing it for I'm doing it because I feel like I have to. And then the way you do those things changes. So that's like, that's part one is like, when I think about self-care, when I think about self-compassion, one of the things I think about is boundaries, which is how many of us have actually taken the time to clarify what's okay or not okay in our life for people, how they treat us, for when and where we give our time and why. To actually like sit down and walk through that exercise is a really big deal, because otherwise, whether we're aware of it or not, there are times where we will say yes to things that we don't actually want to do, let alone do it with love and authenticity and joy.
I can imagine that kind of exercise actually bringing up some, I'm thinking about doing that for myself, and I'm thinking that would probably bring up some quite big shocks, actually, like, you know, of what you've done, maybe where you've sacrificed things, where you've compromised yourself. And then again, asking yourself, well, why did I do that? What was that about? And what kind of is underlying that? You know, what did I need from that situation? Why did I say yes for me to get something that I haven't actually been able to meet for myself, that I was trying to get from the other person? There's a lot of about condition, isn't there? Conditional exchange of things like that. It's really, really interesting.
Which goes back to the niceness. You did it out of niceness rather than kindness.
Yeah, precisely. And then, of course, the reality of when we say yes to something, we're going to say no to something else and vice versa. And that becomes another challenging dynamic. For me, for a long time, I said yes to any speaking engagement at a school that I could imagine. I'm flying all over the place. I'm on planes like literally almost every day. And I was, at the time, I was in a partnership. I was married. And she made often requests that I do less of it. So here I am wandering the country talking about kindness. And I'm like, neglecting another relationship that was most important in my life, which has consequences, right? For myself and ultimately for our relationship. And so I think about like the importance of that balance, that you can outwardly appear kind, but you might be neglecting other areas of your life. So it's like holding those things in balance is one element of self-care, is finding balance in those priorities and what's okay and what's not okay. The other one is navigating, the other thing Brené talks about a lot is the idea of shame. And I think that shame is like outward criticism turned like your inward voice. So often the things that we speak negatively about towards ourselves, it comes in our own voice, right? We hear it in our brains in our own voice, but it's not our own words. It's words that were spoken to us by people that we trusted or cared about or the culture around us. And that's the danger of shame, is that it sounds like us, but it's not us. And so much of the self-love process is finding a voice that is our own, of recognizing what has been told to us as lies. Oftentimes, like so many of the things culture tells us are just lies to convince us to act or be a certain way in the world, because they want something from us, to your point, out of the idea of like family members who need something from us because they have their own wounds, will treat us in a certain way to get that thing that maybe they didn't have. On a more cultural level, companies or organizations will market to us that you are lacking X, Y, or Z in order for you to buy the thing to fill the gap that they created in the first place. And so much of self-love, I think, is self-exploration, self-reflection. It's being okay with being alone because you're willing to confront those voices that sound like you, but aren't you.
Wow, there's so much in that. It's just so true. And Charles and I are both nodding away. Wow. So I'm really interested in, obviously you are, I mean, you're a real advocate for kindness, your whole life's purpose and work is around that. But where did that start? Like, why kindness? Was there something that happened? Was it something that you were passionate about? Was there something you saw a gap in? How did you start your journey on this? And why are you so passionate about it?
I wish I had a better answer for this. My best friend, his name's Esteban, he's a comedian. And he says that someone hugged me in middle school and I thought to myself, I can monetize that, which is a weird, hilarious premise that that's how I got into this.
We need to get him on the next podcast.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, so much of our life is just shaped by the people around us. And I did have two parents that, you know, despite the normal gaps in their own way of growing up and being, they were incredibly loving people in my life. I had an older brother figure who was a few years older than me, who for a billion other reasons was like the kind of person who was cool for all the right reasons. He just like knew people's names and treated everyone with respect. And he was like really popular and loved, but he didn't do any of the things that so many of like high school people do to get attention. You know, they like hurt people or push people down. It's a power struggle. Michael was just like generously and authentically good, and people loved him for it. And so I like had him in my life as like a role model and accountability person. Then I went to summer camp one summer and I met this guy named John who told a story of like what he did in high school to be a leader, which was just show up every morning at the door and hold it for an hour as kids walked in, and the things he learned from that process of how he was treated and the friends he made there. And that inspired me to go back and start a club at my school about kindness and practicing kindness, because that's what I learned from him, was that kindness more than anything was a practice, something we had to do consistently if we wanted to actually be it. And then fast forward to, you know, a decade later, him and I started Character Strong, the company that we now run together. It's that same guy from camp who's on stage telling the story. So it's so much of my story of kindness is just people showing it to me, role modeling it, having my ideas around it, my paradigms around kindness change so many times. And I was just really lucky that in high school, someone changed my mind that kindness looked like this, and it wasn't this thing that the posters told me. And I think that was so shifting for me that I wanted to give that to other people, right? You know, when we have profound experiences like that, we want to like, okay, who else can I tell? This helped me.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've got two teenage boys, and teenagers are interesting because it's a really challenging time when you're a teenager. Lots of things going on physically and emotionally and mentally. And yeah, I can see it in them. They become more withdrawn. They're more self-centered. It's interesting you talking about, obviously, you going to schools, high schools and stuff, and you're talking to probably teenagers as well. What are the kind of sort of messages that you're trying to get across to encourage kindness in them, or at least shifting their mindset around kindness?
It's so much of it is that like skill building of what lives beneath it. So we teach, we call our five ingredients. We talk about emotion understanding and emotion regulation. So do I know how I'm feeling in any given moment? And if I know how I'm feeling, and those feelings are big feelings or challenging feelings, do I know how to regulate it? Do I know how to like understand those emotions in a way that helps me act? Even when I'm feeling really emotional, I can still act in ways that are healthy for me or people around me. We talk about empathy and compassion. So we teach the skills of perspective taking, or when we get to the high school level, we talk about as perspective getting, where we like have to actually go seek out other perspectives. We can't just take them. we talk about compassion and what it looks like to act to alleviate suffering in the world or people around us. We talk about goals and habits. And one of my favorite quotes is my friend Dexter Davis. He says, we're not human beings, we're human becomings, meaning that we don't just be a thing. Like we have to, if I want to be kind, it requires me to choose kindness regularly in my life. I have to become it. And so we talk a lot about goals and habits, not in the traditional school sense, not just academic, like, you know, you're going to get the right grades this semester unit. Mm-hmm. It's more like, what about the goals or habits in our life that foster the kind of people we want to be? In our curriculum, we call it not just our to-do lists, but the who we want to be lists. So it's like, we got to get the school stuff done, but along the way, do we want to be patient, kind, generous, selfless, courageous, whatever those things are? And then we help students think about ways to get there, ways to practice that. We talk about leadership and teamwork. We talk about building agency and then working together to close gaps that we identify in the world. And we talk about values and purpose. We know through the research that values, not telling people what they value, but giving young people an opportunity to clarify what it is they value, where that comes from in their life, when we have clarity around our values, we can more readily use them as like anchors in our life, especially when things get adverse or challenging or overwhelming. We can come back to them as anchors. And so many young people are craving a sense of purpose and autonomy in the world, where a lot of the education system is transactional and they're just like inside of it. And without a sense of purpose in it, it's easy to not care about it. And, you know, some people play the game, but a lot of kids don't, because they're like, I don't know what if I'm even doing here. What is this for? So helping young people think about their purpose in the world and ways that they can be purposeful and create meaning for themselves. So those are the five ingredients, like buckets of things that we teach to. And the intention of those is to create three outcomes, which is an increased sense of belonging, right? We know when we feel psychologically safe in a place, we're going to learn better, be better in that space. Increased well-being, which we know that the mental health crisis in our world, in the US in particular, is huge. So how do we help young people cultivate a deeper sense of well-being? And then engagement. How do we help young people engage in not only their academics in school, but engage in their community, you know, to make it a better place?
Wow. And obviously this, so this podcast, as we've spoken about before, is all about things that people have forgotten were good for them. So if someone's listening, and probably not many of our listeners will not be kind people, but if someone's listening to this episode and they're thinking, well, hang on a minute, Houston, tell me, why should I bother to be kind? Why should I focus on kindness more in my life? What's it going to give me? What would you say?
I think I wrote a blog post when I was like 19 in school called Selfish Altruism. And the premise of it was that you're never going to do something generous to someone else without it benefiting you. It's impossible to be truly selfless in that sense, because we're always going to get something in return. And I think that's the sense that I had in high school when I was like given this new way of thinking about kindness, and I was going to school and starting to practice kindness. I became hooked on the premise that this is like so good for me. The happiness generated by it is so different. Speaking of words that I love, you know, happiness is one of those really clumsy words in the English language. And in Latin, they use different words to talk about happiness. They have the word latus, which is the happiness of a thing. I use the example, I see the pizza, I eat the pizza, I'm happy. The problem with that kind of happiness is that it's really temporary. And a lot of us rely on lots of things to make us happy in a really short-term way. And the next word is, Felix, it's the happiness of comparative advantage. I'm happy because I have more than you. Right? I have nicer clothes than you. I have more money than you. I get better grades than you. I run faster than you. I won this thing and you didn't, whatever that is. Which, of course, the problem with that kind of happiness is that it's relying on someone else's unhappiness. And you're never going to win always. Someone's always going to lose the comparison game eventually. And then there's this word in Latin, it's beatitudo, which is the happiness of seeing good in others and doing good for others, which brings about joy and connection and gratitude. And to me, it's helpful to name those as different from each other, because it's a case for kindness. You can be chasing things or always comparing yourself to someone else's happiness, or you can create a deeper sense of joy by pursuing it, by being proactive and choosing it. And it's harder work, but the contentment and joy that comes from it, I would argue, is that much bigger and deeper as a result of it.
Well, you've definitely won your case with me. If you were in a court of law standing up to make a case for kindness, you got me. You got me all the way. And I think you do that in many ways, but I think you do that actually by putting the kind of the meat on the bone about what kindness actually is. Because I think once people understand really what kindness is, what deep kindness is, and how courageous it is, and how difficult it is, and how much self-awareness you need to have, and how many skills you need to have, when something is challenging and when it's given those attributes, actually people value it more. And I think also people then want to work towards achieving that. You know, in the world we live in, everyone's telling us we should be successful, you know, because success is this, that, and the other, and you need to work hard to be successful, you need to be courageous, you need to whatever, you need to get all these things. Well, what about all these things you need to get or to do or to learn in order to be kind. And I think that's what you're doing. You're making kindness, or you're focusing other people's minds on how kindness is actually a really valuable, difficult skill to build. Mm. And actually, if you build it, you should be really proud of it. And I think when people know that, people are more likely to want to work towards it, because it sounds tough, and it is.
Yeah.
But it's good.
Yeah, it's just like pursuing a degree in law or medicine, or becoming a professional athlete.
The hardest degree ever in the entire world, I think. Forget law and medicine.
Yeah.
Much harder than the degree I did, I think.
Well, Houston, it's been, honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It's fascinating all you're doing, and such inspiring work. I'm really inspired listening to you today. So thank you so much for your time. And it's been a really wonderful conversation.
Yeah, my joy. I love hanging out with fellow people who are thinking about it, wrestling with it, trying to practice it, trying to raise young people who are trying to do the same. Yeah, and maybe the next time we're collectively in a car, we can think of each other and be a little better.
Yes. Everyone who listens to this podcast episode will actually never ever be unkind in a car ever. That's again. Right.
But like we're British, we queue, like, and queues are another perfect place to feel quite unhappy and aggressive.
Yes, that's definitely nice queuing, maybe not kind queuing. Thank you so much, Houston. You've been amazing. Thank you.
Of course.
So that's the end of another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Forgot Podcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.